I was raised in a family that were churchgoers. And going to church way back then, I was taught that there was five types of prayer: glorification, thanksgiving, petition, intercession, and forgiveness. And somewhere along the line, and I'm not too sure where it came up, it occurred to me, what's missing from that is listening.
Yes.
How do you listen to the spirits?
Yeah.
How do you listen beyond what your ears hear?
Welcome to Living 4D with Paul Cech. Today's guest is retired psychologist and ecstatic dance specialist, Nicholas Brink. Nick practiced as a psychologist for over 37 years, during which time he presented many papers at conferences and published numerous papers on hypnosis, guided imagery, and dream work. He was the president of the American Association for the Study of Mental Imagery and sat on the board of directors of the International Association for the Study of Dreams. He retired from private practice after suffering significant hearing loss, and since then he has been certified in ecstatic or shamanic trance, published 9 books, and now leads online groups in ecstatic dance. If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and a warm review at the top of the show page on Spotify or at the bottom of the show page if you are listening on Apple Podcast. Your opinions matter, and your ratings help us to grow and help more people to be healthy, find freedom of body and mind, and to live their dreams. We hope you enjoy listening to Paul and Nick talking about your inner shaman.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to our topic today, your inner shaman, with Dr. Nicholas Brink, who is a PhD in psychology and a very cool man that was turned on to me by Rachel Epstein, who did a great podcast on visualization a while back. So if you haven't listened to that one, it's really good with a lot of great practices. And I looked into Nick's work and his website, and he's got several excellent books. And so his background is in dream work and hypnosis. His dream work, as he will explain, started at UCLA many years ago in his training as a psychologist. His own personal and professional evolution led him into the practice and use of ecstatic trance, which we will explore with him today. And as I said, he's a number of author of a number of excellent books. And so you'll see why the topic today is your inner shaman. So Nick, it's a pleasure to have you here with me and with our listeners.
Thank you. It's a pleasure for me to be here too.
Yes. Nick, you've had a long career as a psychologist and have traveled the world studying shamanism and written many books. You put a lot of emphasis on ecstatic trance as a shamanic practice for journeying, working with spirit guides and power animals, gaining guidance and healing. Could you give us a background overview of your life and what led you to being a psychologist and why you studied hypnosis, shamanism, and ecstatic trance, just to kind of lay the groundwork so everyone gets a sense of who you are?
Okay. You first mentioned Rachel Epstein as referring me to you.
Yes.
I was a president of the American Association for the Study of Mental Imagery, and her husband was one of our prominent speakers, and I got to know him before he died. And so that's how I connected with Rachel. In terms of how I got to where I am, I'm thinking about that question. I had to go way back. I was raised in a family that were churchgoers. And going to church way back then, I was taught that there was 5 types of prayer: glorification, thanksgiving, petition, intercession, and forgiveness. And somewhere along the line, and I'm not too sure where it came up, it occurred to me, what's missing from that is listening.
Yes.
How do you listen to the spirits?
Yeah.
How do you listen beyond what your ears hear? And so I'm not too sure where that came to me, but then I went to UCLA and majored in psychology. And one of my real interests back then were dreams, nighttime dreams, dreams that come to us from beyond our ears. They are to me, they are the spirits that I'm listening to. That's one avenue to hear the spirits, is through dreams and dream work. And listening to dreams, how do I understand what they have to say? One major characteristic of listening beyond my ears is metaphor. These stories come out as metaphor, as sort of symbolic of what's going on in your life. And in dreams, they often may not make sense to you initially, because they are in metaphor. They're sort of poetic. But I learned very early from Gestalt psychology that how to understand a dream is to ask the question, what part of me does this reflect? For example, if in my dream I kick over a can of paint, I should ask, what part of me is making a mess? And that will sort of lead me to a bigger picture. If I take each part of my dream and ask that question, it'll start falling into place as to what the dream means. Then, as a clinical psychologist, I very early was taught hypnosis and how to induce hypnotic trance. And that was a very powerful experience. Again, the trance experiences are coming from beyond your ears, from beyond the five senses of sight, sound, taste, smell, and touch. I think that's a very limiting way of looking at the world, by looking at them through these five senses. So in hypnosis, we again have experiences that are very much metaphoric, like the dreams. From there, because of my interest in dreams and hypnotic experiences, I became aware of the American Association for the Study of Mental Imagery. And I became quite involved in that organization, going to its yearly conferences around the world, here, but also in Europe at times. And in going to those conferences, I would always present a paper. I would write papers on whether it's hypnosis or dream work. And when I went to a conference, I would think, well, what's important to me now? And I'd sort of write down my thinking, and that would end up in a paper that I would give at the conference. And then I think it was in 1989 or 90, somewhere in there, I became president of the association. That was sort of what happened. There was a real conflict within the association between the members that were academic, tied to universities, and then the clinicians. And I really appreciated the academic papers, but a couple of the previous presidents didn't. And so the number of members really very quickly dropped out. We lost the academic people in the association. So soon after I was president, our numbers were such that we did not have a big number of people to go to the conferences. So at that point, we arranged to make this a sort of a subdivision of the International Association for the Study of Dreams. Mm. And I'd been on the board of directors for IASD. I was on that for several years. I was also quite involved in the two hypnosis associations, the American Association for the Study of Clinical Hypnosis and the International Society for Clinical and Experimental Hypnosis. So my original question of what does listening to the spirits mean really led me on this journey, which brought me up to today. And eventually, I discovered Felicitas Goodman and ecstatic trance, which I think I'll be talking about a little bit later in today. But that's another form of listening to the spirits beyond your ears. That's another form of trance.
Where in this process did you start practicing, studying, and orienting yourself towards shamanism in your work as a psychotherapist?
Okay, yes. One important book to me is John Gibser's book, The Ever-Present Origin.
Yes, I've read it. It's excellent.
But it really looks at the evolution of consciousness over time. The very early consciousness, probably from 160,000 years ago, over the first 100, 200,000 years, we were hearing the spirits. They were always alive around us, and that was basically what gave us control over life. Then the next era was the magical era. And where the magical era came in is from cave paintings and from other sources. For example, on a cave painting, a person putting a spear into an animal was a magical way of preparing them to kill the auroch or the whatever animal they were hunting at the time. And what was the difference between that and the earlier eras? Is in the earlier eras, in the earliest era, everyone was basically hearing the spirits. They were all sort of connecting with the world of the spirits. But that sort of ended at one point, and that's when the shaman became important, because the shaman maintained the power of hearing the spirits when everybody else lost it. One explanation of that is Julian Jahn's book, The Origin of Consciousness of the Bicameral Mind. And what he proposed is that in those early times, the two hemispheres of our brain were functioned more separately. And what was heard in the right hemisphere of the brain really seemed like it was coming from outside the body and was being heard as if it's coming from the outside the body in the hemisphere. Then there was the time of evolution where the corpus callosum, the nerve connections between the two hemispheres really became stronger. And the voices that at one point sounded like they were from the outside were experienced on the inside. Julian Jahn's looks back to the Tower of Babel. He really felt that people back then built that tower to try to get closer to the voice of God because they were no longer hearing that. So he really thinks that that was sort of the period when that evolution happened. But now there was a time when we only heard the voices as a shaman picked up the voices and interpreted them for everybody else. Then the next era was
mythic.
The mythic era. Thank you. The mythic era where people started writing these stories down, the stories that they were experiencing. And again, so many of the myths are very metaphoric. That happened. I'm estimating the magical era began probably around 30,000 years ago. The mythical era, I think, estimated around 6,000 years ago. Then about 3,000 years ago, we moved into what they call the era of rationality, of the rational mind. And that mind really only listened to what was reality through the five senses, sight, sound, taste, touch, and smell. That was considered only reality, and the dreams and the trance experiences were considered superstitious or really not part of reality. And now we're moving into a new era, it's been several hundred years that Gibser really suggested that. He thinks that the sort of one suggestion of this new era was Picasso's paintings, where both a frontal view and a side view were apparent in the same painting. But in this last era that we're moving into, he referred to as time-free transparency.
Yes, he calls it the integral stage.
An integral stage. Yes, it's going. That's why the book, going back to our ever-present origin, we are discovering that we have that power to go back to this dream state of our of antiquity, and that the whole idea of time-free is past, present, and future. All sort of in our, if we think about our dreams, as an adult, I very frequently think of myself as an adult, but back in my childhood home, it's free of time, the dream experience. And there's also the transparency, the meaning of it that we need to understand through metaphor, through understanding the metaphor. So his most recent era that we're moving into is the era of time-free transparency. Sometimes we talk about it as being the new age or the age of Aquarius or a number of different names for it. But to me, Gibser's idea of time-free transparency describes more what it's going to be like. I mentioned those two books, Julian Jans and John Gibser. I've often been interested in the Native American way. I had a genome test where they discovered that I have a gene that over half of the Sami reindeer herders in Lapland have. And I really got into reading about the Sami. And again, the shaman of the Sami that's my real fascination hobby, is looking at these hunter and gatherer cultures. And the shaman are a very prominent person in that. And as I read, I discovered that so much of my reading, in reading the ancient myths, they really reflect very clearly, so often, the process of psychotherapy. Two of my books, three of them, I go back and look at the story of Beowulf. Another one is at the Prosetta. And I see these ancient myths as really reflecting the process of psychotherapy. So I became interested in shamanism, sort of, I guess, through that whole process of this in being intrigued and listening to these ancient myths.
That's great.
Hi, everybody. I hope you guys are enjoying the podcast. Did you know that statistics show that only 8% of men and 3% of women do any regularly scheduled exercise, including walking a dog? If COVID taught us anything, it was that now it's more important to be healthy and fit than ever before. Are you ready to create the body you want, get fit, be healthy, love what you see in the mirror, wear the clothes you've always wanted to, and have the confidence that you can do it efficiently and effectively? How about having beautiful abs and a lovely butt too? If your answer to these questions is yes, then stick with me for the next couple of minutes and I'll tell you exactly how you can do it. I'll tell you exactly how I do it. I was shocked while doing research for course development when I came across a study showing that the average person today only knows 8 to 12 exercises. I was just as shocked when I found a completely independent study showing that the average person today only eats 10 to 12 foods, and that's it. They just live off 10 to 12 foods, often don't look or feel well, but don't know why. That's pretty sad when you consider that there are about 350,000 edible plants and a fantastic variety of flesh foods we can eat to ensure adequate nutrient variety to keep ourselves healthy. Many people know they need exercise but feel insecure about going to a gym because they aren't sure what to do there, and a lot of people that could afford a gym membership can't afford a personal trainer, and that, sadly, may be a good thing. Why? Because a significant percentage of personal trainers got their certificate by doing nothing but reading a book and passing a multiple choice test online. There's no specific technical training on many of the most important aspects of technique or the science of exercise. Rarely is there any mention of the importance of diet and lifestyle factors that are integral to any effective conditioning program. This would be like studying to be a medical doctor and only studying the bones and not knowing anything about how the rest of the systems of the body work or how they work together. My dream when I developed Integrated Movement Science Level 1 was to create a truly functional holistic training program that anyone, not just exercise and health professionals, could study, apply, and get fantastic results with. My Integrated Movement Science program not only gives you the essential training on key self-assessments and how to correct any imbalances identified, you learn how to do all the most important functional exercises we can do in a gym with correct form. You also learn the essentials of how to design an exercise program effectively so that you get the results you want, including how to progress each exercise and your exercise program in carefully planned stages so you get healthier, stronger, and fitter without getting injured. The Czech Institute put Integrated Movement Science 1 online so that you can study and practice at your own pace. Any teenager, athlete, or adult can understand what I share and apply it, and it won't be long at all before your friends and all the personal trainers at the gym notice that what you're doing really works and start asking you questions about how you're getting such good results. In fact, you may love the experience so much you decide it's time to change career and become a Czech professional because it feels so good to help others. To help you look and feel your best between now and July 1st, 2023, I'm offering Living 4D listeners a discount of $125 on my Integrated Movement Science course online. That's IMS1 online. To get your discount and start creating a new, healthier, fitter, sexier you, go to chek.group/L4DIMS1. That's check.group/L4DIMS1. This is not case sensitive, so it will work with either upper or lower case. You will get your $125 discount by using the discount code L4DIMS1. That's L4DIMS1. Again, it's not case sensitive. Remember, my special offer ends on July 1st, 2023. Now is your chance to be the change and enjoy showing everyone the new you. I'd love to see what you create. Enjoy your journey.
Nick, the imaginal faculty is at the core of the human psyche and is integral to many shamanic practices, such as shamanic journeying, ecstatic trance, and visionary work, and working with power animals and spirit guides. Could you give us an overview of what the imaginal faculty or function of the human mind is?
One person, David Feinstein, said that you cannot imagine something, you cannot make up a story without it being central to it's impossible to make up a story that doesn't resonate with your inner life. And so to me, whether it's hypnosis or dream time, imagination is in the same category. It doesn't come from your eyes, from your five senses, but it comes from within you. And in ecstatic trance, we often have a new person that joins the group that doesn't really have the full-blown trance experiences that the rest of us have developed. It's often very narrow. They may say, while they went in trance, they felt like they were swaying back and forth, or they may have felt hot, or they may have felt cold. What I ask them to do is to imagine why you're feeling cold, why you're feeling hot, why you're swaying. Is something pushing you or pulling you? Really encourage them to use their imagination to explain their experience, their trance experience. So I really think that the whole idea of the imagination cannot be separated from these other trance and dream experiences.
Yeah, so what you're saying is because in my studies of the imaginal faculty, it's considered to be basically inseparable from our perceptual faculty. In other words, and this correlates to my next question, because one of the most common questions I get from students in my workshops and my own patients and clients that I work with when I'm doing this kind of work with them is, they say to me, Paul, how do I know I'm not just imagining all of this? You know, like if they meet a power animal or a spirit guide, that's one of the first things they say is, how do I know I'm not just making it up in my head?
Yeah. I had one person in one of my ecstatic trance groups. He was actually a professor, a teacher of physics in high school. And he wasn't really developing very clear imaginal experiences in trance. And one day he came up with this really elaborate story that was beautiful. And I had to point out to him, you are using your imagination, but that is part of reflecting what's going on internally within you. And so we had a good time with looking at his experience from that perspective. What was your question again?
What I was wanting to get to really was your thoughts on the difference between the imaginal faculty and imagination. Like, you know, if someone's doing a power animal retrieval with you and they see an elephant inside of them, that's the imaginal faculty. But if you said, imagine an elephant in the room, what would it look like? And someone says, well, I see an elephant that's pink with polka dots, then that's the imagination versus the imaginal. The power animal would come by way of the imaginal faculty, which is an aspect of our inner perception. And Jung basically describes that it's the imaginal faculty that produces images. So if you think about somebody you love, you see them in your mind. If you think about how you're going to, you know, fix a broken tool, then you're probably visualizing it in your mind. So Jung and others would distinguish that as the imaginal faculty versus imagination. So when people say to me, how do I know I'm not just imagining it? You know, what I tell them is imagination is an active process. If I say, imagine an elephant and then paint it up as wild as you want and tell me what it looks like, you're actively engaged in the process. Just like if I say, what's the square root of 69? You're going to have to turn your brain on and do the math. But when you're doing a trance type power animal retrieval or spirit guide retrieval, your mind is completely relaxed and empty. And instead of imagining, it's appearing without any agency of your own. It's like you're the TV screen and the movie appears all by itself.
I think it takes practice. I think it takes experience to move from the imagination to the imaginal mind. I think that they're really connected. They're really related. But I think it takes some practice to learn how to let go of your active mind to be able to just let it happen.
I agree. So that's sort of what I was trying to get to, but I think we've distinguished that. I agree. We're so left brain dominant and so caught in our mental faculty. Many people don't spend any time in the practice of what would be standard be a meditation practice of just letting their mind relax and empty itself. One of my favorite meditations is what I call no mind. And I just sit in my sauna, empty my mind. And then I say to my soul, if there's anything you want to talk to me about, just show me or tell me. And so all of a sudden I might see an image of a woman walking in the forest or something. And then I will go travel in spirit body and talk to her and say, well, you know, you must be a message from my soul. Who are you? And what are you here to tell me? So that's the imaginal, but I'm not imagining it because I had no idea whether a woman or a dragon or a cow would show up. You know, I just work with what soul gives me. But like you say, it takes practice to learn to let the unconscious bring its messages and its images and its gifts to you. But most people have so much traffic in their head, they don't ever get to see what's the wealth of wisdom that's hiding inside of them.
You're talking about two things here, too. One is in my ecstatic trance groups, women are much more spontaneous in presenting a imaginal experience than men. I think men tend to be more rational. And the other is that I had it in my notes maybe a little bit later on, but the difference between a hypnotic or a dream experience and a static trance. Mm-hmm. And the dream experience is really very spontaneous, while the ecstatic trance has more intent. It's more directed. So that, to me, that's one distinction that I think is helpful to look at, that I think that men often will relate to the ecstatic trance experience more than women.
What are some ways anyone can engage their imaginal faculty for healing or personal and spiritual growth? If you want to maybe make some suggestions that anyone listening could try to begin working with their imaginal faculty.
Wow. Let's go off in a little different direction here. Carlos Castaneda, he talks about dreaming and stalking. Dreaming is letting go of what you're thinking. In other words, blanking your mind, like you said, just imagine no thoughts in your mind. And the dreaming is much more like hypnosis. In hypnosis, I lead the person into a quiet time where they where their mind is just flowing without direction. While in a static trance, you go into it with a intent, with a posture. We'll talk when I get down to that section. We'll talk more about the postures of a static trance. But the posture gives direction. The drumming of the shamanic drumming or rattling distracts your mind, and it really is sort of a different experience. It's much more the stalking experience of Carlos Castaneda.
That sounds good. So, you know, so what I'm hearing you say so far is people could explore shamanic drumming. They could use rattles. They can use no mind meditation. They can use audio tracks that have already got pre-prepared shamanic drumming and trance exercise music, so they can just relax into it and let whatever rises. Another way that I do it is I empty myself and I paint a circle on a canvas, and then I just say to my soul, please take the brush and just paint whatever it is that you'd like me to be aware of, or whatever message you want to give me, or whatever you'd like to express through me. And I have no idea what I'm going to paint. And so I just empty. And if I feel drawn to black, then I take black. And then if I just empty myself and say, okay, what do you want to paint? And I might see, you know, a shaman's face or a bear or something. So I'll just paint that. And then I'll just empty and say, what's next? And so I just kind of completely let go. And it's as though I'm being painted through, like I'm a medium for my soul's expression. So that's a sort of a nice self-induced trance mechanism.
I think there's so many different ways to reach that imaginal mind. And that's one, the art one. We've had in our groups of several artists that really have done that, have had them just paint something random. And to me, that, for me personally, I'm not an artist. We have one person who always often had us do a mandala and begin with that. And I think that's beautiful. Somehow, I just always felt more personally more awkward in trying to express something in a drawing or a painting, to where that hasn't been part of what I do with a static trance.
Yeah, I think the feeling of awkward is one that is really common. You know, I've taught mandala workshops for many, many years, and I'm an art therapist. But I think what's really important for the listeners, if you want to try this, is to have no attachment to what it looks like. Right away, the more resistance you have to what it looks like, the more you're bound in Freud's superego or judging consciousness. The secret is to not care and just let the child in you take the brush or the crayons or the pencils or the pens. But it's such a beautiful experience to have this detached childlike playfulness, and without putting any thought to it, like I'm going to draw this or I'm going to just let whatever wants to come through you come through. And when you finish it, just use it as a meditation piece and let it start talking to you. And I find people just have mind-blowing experiences as to what
kind of comes through them.
Beautiful. That's really a beautiful approach to the whole thing. I think there are so many different approaches to getting to the imaginal mind. I think Reiki is another way. I think there's so many different schools of thought, and it just so happens that I really got hooked into ecstatic trance. I began with probably with Tai Chi, with movement, and I think movement does a lot.
Yes,
can be the same thing. It could give you different images, and I know in doing Tai Chi, when I was doing it out in our yard, I was giving off the whole feeling of being peaceful and quiet and not a threat. And these two deer came up pretty close to me and just watched what I was doing. I think there's so many different avenues, and it just so happens that I got booked into the one of ecstatic trance.
Yes, I practiced Tai Chi daily for 18 years and have had many deep experience of the imaginal mind and even been brought into non-dual experiences, which were very, very powerful and sometimes shocking. So I believe that rhythmic movement, especially if it's coupled with your breathing so that the movement and the breathing cycles are synchronized, can take you into some amazing flow states that really bring you into contact with your unconscious and give you a really beautiful depth of experience that a lot of people that are kinesthetically oriented don't get through these other sort of more mentally directed practices.
Earlier, you mentioned spirit guides. I think that was a very important aspect to me. I think in terms of the Zoom groups that I do with ecstatic trance, I have so many spirit guides that come alive within me, whereas the other ones in the group don't too often really connect with a spirit guide. And this was back in the 80s in the American Association for the Study of Mental Imagery. We had Rene Pellier come in and do a workshop with us. And what he had us do is imagine an animal coming out of our chakra, each of our chakra. And those were some of my first four. He only did four chakras. But I had out of one a buffalo and a bear and a mouse and a squirrel. And these really became important spirit guides to me. They really gave me a new direction in life. And that's why when I got into ecstatic trance, I have probably 20 or 30 different spirit guides now that I call upon. And they really become alive within me. I think in our group, another one is, what are some of the other spirit guides? They're the plant spirit guides. And I will go outside to a plant and go through four different postures. The first posture is becoming acquainted with the plant. The second posture is falling in love with the plant.
Mm.
The third posture is marrying the plant.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fourth is going beyond marriage into how it changes your life. So I've used those four steps to really bring plants alive within me as spirit guides.
I love it.
Another one is the colors of the rainbow, the seven chakra. I have the stones that this is quite recent for me, but over the last 6 months, I think it is, I will so often be moved to holding one or two of the stones in my hand that represent each of the seven, that represent two of the seven chakra. And that those colors have really given me more direction in some of my experiences.
That's fantastic. Angie, my wife, who's a shaman, and I run power animal and spirit guide retrieval workshops to help people find them and teach them how to work with power animals and spirit guides. And I have a long history of that kind of work myself, and I love it.
Hi, everybody. I'm super excited to be able to share this podcast with you, and I wanted to take a moment to tell you about one of my secret methods for keeping me vital and strong, and that's Organifi's Balanced Probiotic Formula in capsules. Organifi Balanced Capsules gives your gut system the support it needs to help you feel better in many ways. I suspect by now you've seen one of the many excellent documentaries showing how essential the health of our microbiome is and how consuming the right probiotic bacteria can really help your body, emotions, and mind in many ways. Each dose of Organifi Balance capsules includes five of the most important probiotic bacteria for a healthy body, and Organifi guarantees 20 billion colony-forming units of probiotic bacteria per serving, which ensures that a significant amount of health-giving bacteria will make it through your stomach into your small intestine and colon, where they can do their magic. Organifi's Balance formula supports GI health, supports you in having a healthy digestive system, probiotic replenishment, promotes gut flora diversity, supports healthy gut flora, maintains healthy gut balance, reduces bloating and gas, and supports you in having regular bowel movements, which improves detoxification, helps you reduce or eliminate abdominal discomfort, improves digestion and absorption, supports your immune system, and gives it the boost you need for a healthy immune response. To get your 20% L4D discount on Organifi Balance formula and capsules and support your health and vitality each day, go to organifi.com/check20. That's organifi.com/check20. For your Living 4D discount on checkout, use the code capital C, capital H, capital E, capital K, 20. As an added bonus, you can use your Check 20 discount code on all purchases and subscriptions and get 20% off. Feel free to visit the website for more technical information on the ingredients in Organifi Balance. Enjoy.
Could you give the listeners some conceptual framework to understand what a power animal and a spirit guide is? A lot of people think that's just a bunch of made up bullshit, but you know, of course, people usually have negative opinions about things they don't understand, you know, and I've had patients who felt that way, but not one of them couldn't identify what their power animal was when I took them through the process. So how would you describe what a power animal and a spirit guide is? And if there's any differences in your concept between them, what are they?
I have around the room here, six leather shields that have been painted to represent different animal spirit guides within me. One of the earliest ones, I was sitting in an alley and there's a garbage can across from me. And there was a mouse that was asking me if he could go rummage in the garbage can. Then about near the same time, I was in my driveway washing the car, and there was a tree sort of next to me, and there was a squirrel in the tree asking me to climb the tree to the higher level. What those two experiences really said to me when I looked at it metaphorically is there was that part of me that was rummaging in the garbage. That was the mouse. I was asking my person to rummage in the garbage. But there was the newer part of me that was climbing the tree to a higher spiritual level. So I think a soaring eagle is flying higher and higher and higher. And it really, in some of my experiences, that was telling me to rise above certain conflicts. I had prostate cancer, and the eagle became a very important spirit guide at that. And the bear and the eagle. The eagle gave me the power to rise above my anxiety about the whole thing. And the bear gave me strength and nurturing strength to deal with the prostate cancer. So I think that each of the animals have an important message to you, and what that animal does really tells you something that's important to you. The coyote is another. That's a more recent spirit guide that I've had, but it always brings me conflict, things that it's trying to get me to laugh at. It's the trickster. It tries to trick me into letting go of some conflict and really moving beyond that. So I think the animals, when you really look at them, I mean, I think children so often, they grow up with animal stories. And the animal stories give you an image of what the animal is like. I mean, there's so many of the children's stories are centered around animals. And I think that's something that we begin with. But as we look at what the animal is trying to say, it really opens up new dimensions in terms of our imaginal understanding.
What I'm trying to help the listener discern and understand is, and hear your opinion on is, are they, in your opinion, are they beings that we imagine? Are they aspects of our own soul? Or do you think it's the spirit of the animal coming to us as a separate entity that wants to interact with us in some way?
Wow, that's a good one. Yes, I'd say it could be both or either one of them. I think our so often what's coming from our unconscious mind is reflected in our experience, and it's something coming from within us. But I think with these experiences, we reach a point of going beyond our unconscious mind to what I might call the universal mind, or the Jungian term collective unconscious, which there are those messages that come to us from beyond us. So I think that I think in our static trance groups, initially, that's usually a reflection of what's going on with inside of you, some conflict, some issue that you're dealing with, and it's the spirit guide may be giving you suggestions that are alive within you. But then as you really grow with that, you'll start to discover that these answers are coming from outside of you. And so often an animal is a good avenue to look at that maybe from outside of you.
Yeah, there's a lot on that. I actually did you might find this interesting on my YouTube channel. For those listening, it's youtube.com/PaulCheck, C-H-E-K, that is, live, youtube.com/PaulCheckLive. If you go on that YouTube channel that I just gave, Nick, and just search Paul Check Power Animals and Spirit Guides, I put about a 90-minute presentation really breaking down what power animals and spirit guides are to help people understand that. But it's such a comprehensive presentation, it would be too much to get into, but I was just curious as to how you perceive them, which is, I love what you shared as well. I think there's a lot to that.
One thing that people, the whole idea of shape-shifting, of becoming the animal.
I love that.
People in a site say, well, I didn't actually become the animal, but the fact is that I think in trance, you if you become an animal, it really does feel alive within you. It doesn't have to physically be there in the room with you, but you're not going to grow antlers and be the animal that you're imagining, but still the shape shifting to become spiritually connected to the animal is so important.
Yeah, I think it helps us reconnect to our roots. And you know, if you look at the structure of the nervous system, for example, you can study Paul McLean's research on the triune mind and look at the structure of the brain, the reptilian, mammalian, and then neocortical systems. And then you can also look at the DNA. And what I've found through my own inner investigations is that what they call junk DNA is actually the history of all the evolution of species on the planet. And we carry the DNA connection, which is a cosmic antenna, a subtle energy antenna, so that we always have the psychic information, which to what Rupert Sheldrake would call the morphogenic fields or the consciousness, the formative right. consciousness of all these animals and insects and everything on the planet. So that we, when we go into meditation, our soul can give us the message from the bear or the message from the mouse or the message from the eagle or the message from the wolf, because we are actually the evolutionary tip of all of those species brought into one organism. So inside of us, the way I perceive it is we actually have the DNA link up to access the information fields where the intelligence of those beings resides, because we carry all of that with inside of us.
Very nice way of describing it, yes.
When you bring people into ecstatic trance, or if they want to bring themselves into it, is it typically done by drumming or some sort of rhythmic music? Or what are some of the ways anybody can practice entering into ecstatic trance?
I think you're bringing me to describing the whole definition of ecstatic trance or where it's coming from. Felicitas Goodman was is from Hungary, but was educated in Germany and as a linguist, and she learned about 20 different languages. Then she came to the United States and settled down in Columbus, Ohio, where she was on the Ohio OSU campus. And while she was there, she was popular there because she did a lot of translating for faculty from different research articles into English. I mean, she knew about 20 languages.
Wow.
She met this one anthropologist who was studying ecstatic trance in like 187 different primitive cultures around, or hunter and gatherer cultures around the world. And she decided to get her PhD in anthropology at that point, and with this woman, with this professor as being her advisor. To her dissertation, in terms of becoming, in terms of researching what is ecstatic trance, and with her ability with languages, she went to Mexico, and she went to both Mayan-speaking and Spanish-speaking apostolical churches where they spoke in tongues. She believed that speaking in tongues was one form of ecstatic trance. And from that, she concluded that there was four basic elements. One was believing that your experience was not crazy, but normal and healthy. Two, that it was done in a sacred or special place. Three, there was quieting the mind, which in the church it was prayer. And four, there was the rapid stimulation to the nervous system. In the church, it was hand clapping, but she returned to her university, Denison University, where she was teaching at the time, and she created an indigenous ritual that really involved those three things, or those four things. One is she would discuss the whole idea of what is trance-like. Two, she would create a sacred space by both smudging and calling the spirits of each direction. This created the sacred space around you. She then would have you quiet your mind by following your breathing for 5 minutes, just to be aware, conscious of your breathing and following it for 5 minutes. That would quiet your mind. Then she induced trance by either rattling or drumming at approximately 180 beats a minute, which was sort of defined by, Michael Harner. He's the one that came up with that number. And she found her students really went into trance experiences, but there was something missing. Their trance experience was not directed. It was just into a trance state. And in the church, the belief that the Holy Spirit was speaking through you is what gave direction to the speaking in tongues. But that wasn't part of her the time in the classroom. The students went into a trance experience, but without direction. Then she read an article by V.F. Emerson, a Canadian psychologist, who was looking at different body postures, the lotus posture, and different postures for different meditation practices. And in, he would have them meditator go into trance in those postures, and he would measure your skin moisture, your breathing rate, your heart rate, your bowel motility. He had a bunch of different measurements that he was making when you went into a trance. And he discovered that the different body postures had different effects on the body.
Mm.
And this turned on a light within Felicitas. She then looked at ancient art, whether it's in museums or books on anthropology, and found what she believed were approximately 50 different postures that she believed that the hunter and gatherer shaman were using. And she had her students sit, stand, or lay in these postures while she induced trance. And what she found was different body postures gave a different direction to trance. Let me see. Let me describe a couple different postures. One is standing with your hands on your abdomen, your lower abdomen. That's the bear spirit posture. There's a wood carving from British Columbia, but she's found the bear spirit posture in many different places around the world, where you have your hands on your lower abdomen around your Dian Chi. And what she found is that brought in a healing, strengthening energy within the body. Then there were the postures, so many of them, quite a few of the postures, you think of Rodin's The Thinker. With The Thinker, your hand was against your forehead, but in her postures, there's a gap there to allow information in.
Okay.
These postures were postures for divination, for finding answers to questions. Then there were the shape-shifting postures. That was one of the very first ones I ever used, where I'm sitting on the floor cross-legged with my knuckles on the floor in front of me as if they're four legs. And I very quickly became a high-stepping buffalo. And so those are three of them. Then there are the postures for journeying into the underworld, for journeying in the middle world, or for going into the upper world. The lower world postures are all laying down. There's the Sami posture, where I'm laying on my stomach with my arms above my head. Then there's the Michael Harner Javaro posture, where he's lying on his back with his hand on his forehead. These postures are for going into the underworld, for exploring something. And so often when I do every time I use one of those two postures, I find myself drifting into a cave underwater somewhere in the underworld that has a story to give me. The middle world postures, there's the Venus of Malta, where she's standing with her hands down, looking very planted. Her feet are very planted. She's heavy set, and she really is connected to the earth.
That's great, yeah.
That particular posture, I find, is a middle world posture that sometimes takes me back in time, or it takes me at different places in the middle world, but it's a middle world posture. Then there is the upper world postures, and most all of those, some part of it that's at 37 degrees, she measured. There's some cave paintings where the person is resting on a platform of some sort at 37 degrees. There's the Venus of Galgenberg, where your hand's up at like a 37 degrees. But all these postures have a lack of connection to the earth, where you feel there's an energy that's going into the upper world. And those postures take me up into the cosmos, up into the Milky Way, the moon, the sun, that provide different experiences. That's three, four, that's six of them. The seventh one is the death and rebirth posture that really brings about an initiation into something new. And to me, that posture is very powerful. It's your hands on your waist, with the knuckles against your waist, sort of like the Belinda Gore in her book. She talks about the teacup posture, where you have a handle of a teacup, but she has two handles, one on either side. What is that? What is that posture expressing? When I ask people in the group, what does that express? They first say, "Well, my mom's angry at me or whatever. But when you ask the posture itself, what is it expressing? It's expressing a sense of determination. This is my energy is for determination. It's a determination of letting go of some unhealthy part of you and having a rebirth with something healthier or new. To me, it's a very important posture to bring about that final change of healthiness, of letting those aspects of you die and letting other aspects of you take their place and become healthy. So those are basically the seven postures. And there's a couple other postures that are for calling the spirits, but those seven are the important ones.
Hi, everybody. I'm sure grateful to have you on this journey with me and listening to the podcast and picking up new and interesting ways that we can all work together to make the world a better place for all living beings now and in the future. Today, I'm really excited to tell you about Paleo Valley's new wild-caught fish roe. Have you ever tried wild-caught fish roe? I grew up on Vancouver Island, British Columbia, and each year during the salmon run, fish roe was plentiful, and when I'd eat it, I could just feel my body saying yes and wanting more. And that is exactly what happens every time I use Paleo Valley's carefully freeze-dried wild-caught fish roe capsules. Fish roe is an excellent addition to your daily health plan and is prized around the world by various cultures, containing an array of beneficial nutrients you'd get with whole food fish. Paleo Valley's wild-caught fish roe comes from fish caught by sustainably minded fishermen committed to preserving fish runs for future generations, and it's super clean and healthy. It gives your body a great dose of easily absorbed omega-3 fatty acids, which are super important and helpful. In fact, a recent study found 68% of American adults are not consuming enough omega-3s, and 89% had levels in the dangerously low range associated with high cardiovascular risk. Omega-3 deficiencies can cause imbalances in the omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acid ratio, causing things like unhealthy levels of inflammation, low energy levels, poor memory, joint discomfort, dry skin, heart problems, mood swings, and even depression. Fish roe is rich in essential long-chain omega-3 fatty acids from eicosapentaenoic acid, EPA, and docosahexaenoic acid, DHA, which have been linked to less inflammation in consumers, improved cognitive function, healthy mood and mental health, better vision, healthy blood pressure, supported cardiovascular health, and strong immune function, and more. Plus, Paleo Valley wild-caught fish roe is enhanced with other additional compounds and nutrients such as protein, DPA, choline, selenium, vitamins E, C, D, B2, and phospholipids for added benefits. To get your Paleo Valley fish roe, go to paleovalley.com/check15. That's paleovalley.com/check15. Living 4D listeners save 15% on purchase using the code CHEK15 at checkout. Check 15. If you're interested in research to back anything I've shared here, feel free to reach out to Paleo Valley and they can help you. Enjoy feeling great eating Paleo Valley's wild-caught fish roe capsules each day. I love them, and I use them every day.
When I was president of the American Association for the Study of Mental Imagery, we invited Felicitas Goodman. Someone suggested her, and I didn't know who she was at the time, but someone in the group suggested her as one of our keynote speakers. So I phoned her, and she agreed, and that's what got me to read her book. Where the Spirits Ride the Wind. But that's where things started falling apart. I was doing this at Penn State, and there's a big mix-up on the printing, and the brochure never got out except about 2 weeks before the conference, and we had hardly anybody sign up for it. Uh-oh. So the conference was canceled, so I never did meet Felicitas in person. She died a couple years later. I did talk to her briefly on the phone one day, but as a result of reading her book, I did a workshop each morning at the Dream Association Conference for 4 mornings in a row. I did a special workshop where I used 4 different postures. And I had a group of, I think there was like 14 of us in the group. And it really blew my mind how these postures really reflected what she said the postures would bring about. I think I was in a very special group because these people were dreamers that were interested in their dreams, and so they were very susceptible to what the posture expressed. But it really blew my mind that the postures really did bring about what she said they would bring about. So that was about 16 years ago. So when I came home, I started a group that we met every week. I had there was initially 14 of us in the group, then it would evolve and some would leave, others would join. But it was powerful. I started collecting their experiences. Felicitas, she would have, at the end of the experience, she would have each person write in their journal what their experience was. I had them write on an index card or cards what their experience was, and I collected these cards. I transcribed them. I sent them back by email to the person, but I ended up having 4,000 or 5,000 different ecstatic trance experiences, which really became a source for my writing. It really opened the door for the books that I've written. That's sort of a brief story of where ecstatic trance came from. At the time of, I had two groups. I moved up here to New York about 4 years ago, and I very quickly started two groups up here in the Hudson Valley for ecstatic trance. And they were fairly popular. We had a good number of people joining them. But then came about COVID. And so we stopped meeting in person and we started doing it on Zoom. And so I now have two Zoom groups, which are the people in the Zoom groups really see it as a family. They really feel very close to each other. And one is Tuesday nights and the other is Friday mornings. I have the different times because of different parts of the world. I have different people from Europe. I've had somebody from Korea, someone from Australia. I have several from British Columbia as part of our ecstatic Zoom group. And anybody who is interested in it, they could email me and we'd be happy to have you join us and experience what ecstatic trance is all about.
What's the email?
My email is brinknick9, BRINKNICK9, @gmail.com. And if they email me, I'd be happy to send them the Zoom links for those sessions, and they could join us whenever they felt like it. Some people, I know the woman in Germany, she comes on maybe once a month. She's just too busy to come on other times. There was one man in Belgium who comes on probably most every Friday, because that time works for him in Belgium. Well, the Tuesday evening one would be way too late for him.
That's cool. You know, when you consider that the body is a cosmic antenna, one of the ways I describe postures to my students is, first of all, I point out that in Chinese medicine, they have postures for all sorts of different illnesses and diseases. Mm-hmm. And so do they in yoga. And so when you realize that the body is a cosmic antenna, the analogy I give to some of my students are too young to remember this, but you would know, you know, when you used to have a television that you had to use aerials or a radio, you'd have to keep playing with the aerials by lengthening or shortening and adjusting the position until all of a sudden the signal came clear. And so I tell them that's exactly what you're doing with your body, because you're in a sea of cosmic energies that are full of information. And by moving your body into the right position, you do exactly what you do with the aerials. And all of a sudden the signal that carries the type of information that posture connects to becomes available to you. And a lot of people just don't think of their bodies as cosmic antennas. So they're kind of detached from how a posture could actually influence these types of things.
Right. The cosmic antenna thing, I think when you think about physics, modern physics, the whole idea of E equals MC squared.
Right.
I remember back when I was an undergraduate, I was a physics major for a while. And back then, that was 60 years ago. And they couldn't say whether whether matter was a wave or a matter. But I think Einstein really answered that question, that we are all energy. We are the E side of the equation. But once that energy is observed, it becomes matter. And so when we look around us, the things that we create around us were originally just wave motion, but when we visualize them or when we measure them, they become substance and they become real. So yes, that idea of energy, of the body flowing, all these objects are basically energy, and energy is important to really appreciate. So
yeah, one of the things I wanted you to do for the listeners, because I imagine a lot of them don't have much background in shamanism, could you give us a description of what the upper world, middle world, and lower world is, so that people can kind of reconnect with what you were talking about earlier?
Okay, I'll try. I haven't had to think this one through for a minute. The underworld, I think, is our unconscious mind. If I want to merge with my unconscious mind, I will go into the underworld. And the experiences I have there, whether it's in the cave or swimming through water or whatever it might be, it really is a connection to our unconscious mind. The middle world is a bit more concrete. It is what we see and what we experience around us. But when we look at that, whatever it is, it has many different dimensions. I could look at the buffalo, or we have bear. We have a bear out here in our yard periodically. I could look at a bear, and it has a message to say. Two primary messages from the bear. One is strength, and the other is nurturing. And they both occurred to me. I have sat in a bear's lap in my imagery experiences and nursed off the bear's tit. The bear was a nurturing experience for me there. And other times I could feel the bear's strength, the powerful strength. So there's many different dimensions to the middle world. Sometimes it takes me into the past. One of my experiences, I was using the Halsted warrior posture, where one arm's around my waist, the other's up at my shoulder. And that's from 6,000 years ago. And it's considered a realm of the dead posture. And in that posture, I found myself back 6,000 years ago in a cave with a number of men that were preparing for a hunt. And one of the men in the group who said, "Oh, since you're from the future, you know things that we don't know. Will you lead us on the hunt tomorrow?" Mm-hmm. And I really felt that particular person was a distant ancestor of mine. This is one of that was my very first ancestral experience. And I first said, "Oh, I can't do that. I don't know anything about that." But he said, you need to do it." So we slept in the cave overnight, and the next morning they all got up and they're prepared to go for a hunt, and they had me go outside, and I sort of led them through the woods, and we came to a small herd of deer, and I indicated for them to surround the deer and herd them over this cliff where they fell to their death. And it was a very successful hunt with my leading, even though I didn't know I had any power. But that was one of my very first ancestral experiences that led me into a whole series of other ones in Scandinavia.
That's great.
And the upper world, that's often for me a more spiritual experience. When I mentioned earlier the I didn't mention the postures, but the four experiences of leading me to become connect with a medicinal herb or some plant. The first posture is a divination posture where I want to get to know the animal, I mean, the plant in more depth. You know, I mentioned that as the Rodan posture is sort of similar to the divination posture. So I use a divination posture to first connect with the plant. Then I say the next one is a falling in love. And I use the Chilton spirit posture, which has one hand on the chest, on over the heart. And I often will have them hold a leaf of the plant against their heart. And that's falling in love. Then I will have the marriage posture is blocking on what posture I use for marriage. But then I have them the marriage posture. Then the fourth posture is that marriage goes into a spiritual experience. So I will use the Venus or Gorgon posture where your hand is pointing to the heavens to rise into the cosmos to take my marriage into a higher level of spirituality. So going into the upper world, it really brings alive the spirituality within you, whether it's going to the Milky Way or to the moon or to the sun or to the just in general through space. It brings alive the spiritual side of an experience.
Great. Yeah, it reminds me of the image of the magician on the Rider-Waite cards where he has one arm with his wand up and the other one pointing down, which is, of course, as above, so below. But he's accessing the above with the very posture that you've just demonstrated with his arm up.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, those are all very fascinating concepts that I really love. I'm glad you're sharing them. Nick, you've probably written more about ecstatic trance, its uses, and your experience of ecstatic trance than anybody in the world. I don't know anyone that's written as many books as you have on the topic. Could you give us a couple of gems from each of your books and inform us how we could use them in our daily lives?
First book I wrote was Grundle and His Mother, Healing the Trauma of Childhood Through Dreams, Imagery, and Hypnosis. I wrote that one before I learned about ecstatic trance. And I really felt that every element of that myth had something to do with psychotherapy. There's the two monsters that really were attacking King Hrothgar. There was the Grendel and Grendel's mother. And those are two tormentors within you that need to be overcome. And throughout the story of Beowulf, those monsters are overcome, and the Beowulf, who's the one that comes in and ends up killing these monsters, he becomes king. He becomes king of the Geats. So really, to me, that whole myth is a way to overcome those tormentors within you to reach the higher level of spirituality. I think of maybe a more common story is the 12 labors of Hercules. There's 12 different monsters that he has to deal with. But in dealing with those 12 monsters, he eventually becomes a god. Initially, he's not considered a god, but then he becomes a god. But I think each of these stories, so many of the myths are myths of healing, like Grendel and his mother. Then I discovered ecstatic trance. And my first book was The Power of Ecstatic Trance, where I go through I have a lot of stories in here of people who seek healing from ecstatic trance, from a certain posture. And each of these postures are considered healing postures. And basically, they're geared to healing. But one of my favorite stories is of Maria. She was in one of my very first groups, and she's really probably the first person to really give me the image of how these postures were healing. Actually, I forget which posture she was using, But what she experienced, she found herself in a city, and she referred to it as her city. It was polluted. It was really sort of a depressing city. But with that pollution all around her, she was walking through an industrial part of the city. She came to this bridge, and she got up on the bridge, and ahead of her was this factory that she did not want to go through. She tried to come out of trance, but she didn't. She couldn't come out of trance. So she took a deep breath and walked ahead through this factory, and it was really an ugly, polluted place inside. But she came out the other side, and it was beautiful. It was green. It was healthy. It was really a beautiful area. And she went over and laid down on the grass. When she came to me, she was struggling with quitting smoking. And she was having a hard time with it. But after that experience, that was about 16 years ago, she has not had a cigarette since. And I know her pretty well still. What does that story say? It really is a metaphor for what it takes to go quit smoking. You begin in a polluted self, I mean, with the smoke inside of you. It's your polluted city. And it takes somehow facing that and going through it to discover that you don't have to have that cigarette, that it could be clean and beautiful and healthy without the cigarette. I think that whole experience that she had was a very collapsed experience of the process to quit smoking. It only took her 20 minutes to go through that experience, but she did not have all the struggles that she was having with before in terms of gaining weight or all the other things that may happen, becoming irritable when you don't have a cigarette. She didn't go through all those. She went through those in her imagery and came out the other side, and it was healthy. So that's one story I have in this first book of The Power of Ecstatic Trance: Practices for Healing, Spiritual Growth, and Accessing the Universal Mind. That's what we talked about a few minutes ago, the accessing the universal mind, that trance allows you to go beyond yourself into the universal mind.
P3OM by Bioptimizers is hands down one of the most important supplements to have on you everywhere you go. If you're traveling, if you go to work, if you're going to friend's house to eat, this product will knock out food poisoning and almost any kind of gut disorder from viruses, bacteria, fungi, whatever could irritate your gut so quickly. It's mind-blowing. I have been using this product since Wade Lightheart first turned me on to it, and he's the formulator of it. And I've got Wade here to tell us how it works, but I just want you to hear it from me. I have all my clients use this. I try to get it to friends, to family members, because it is really like your own bodyguard. So Wade, how in the world does this thing work so well every time?
Well, as you know, we're very research oriented, and we have literally a university in Croatia that we do microbiome testing with our labs of PhDs to find out what's the most effective formulation. And we are quickly moving into the post-antibiotic world where we need to cultivate super probiotics. We all heard of super bad bacteria in hospitals and stuff that are antibiotic resistant. Well, what we did, we worked with a medical doctor that was able to take an aggressive strain of L. plantarum, which is a very aggressive strain, and then put it through almost like a buds camp, a Navy SEALs training, where we subjected this particular probiotic to a toxic environment. We ran a sine wave through it, and out of that survived only about somewhere between 2-3%. We then take that and grow it on very special food. We feed them, just like you would feed a great athlete, you feed them special food, and the probiotics develop unique capabilities. We have a US patent that is so powerful, I can't read it on the airwaves because we'd get canceled. But what I can say is when you put P3OM in your body, it goes out and breaks down any undigested protein, whether it's in your gut or through your blood system. And it becomes your Navy SEALs defense force, if you will, to go out and wipe out whatever pathogen might come in your body, you just need more of these guys to overwhelm it. It takes it out. It cleans up any messes. And for the last 18 years, I've been using P3OM daily. And I can honestly say I've never been sick during that time. If I feel something coming on, I just double down my dosage, take 4 caps every night. If I get a little, if I'm traveling, I take twice that. And it's been great. A lot of our people do it. And it's one of our best-selling products. And it's available to your audience. Just go to p3om.com/living4d. Put in Paul10, get a 10% discount. And if it's not the best probiotic you've ever had in your life, you get 100% of your money back. That's from us at Bioptimizers. That's our guarantee for you.
Go get it. It's for real. I love the stuff. Thank you, Wade. I love what you're sharing. And the reason I wanted to do this with you is because I wanted the listeners to know which books might have approaches that could help them with the kinds of challenges maybe they're experiencing. And it's, you know, a lot of people listening because they're not therapists. There is a lot of doctors and therapists that do listen to my podcast. Uh-huh. But I've been using these types of techniques with people for, you know, many, many years. And so is my wife, Angie, as a shaman. And it's quite amazing. I mean, people don't realize how powerful these things are. And the nice thing about them is they're a lot safer than medical drugs and the kind of things that people typically do. And, you know, it doesn't hurt you at all to try them. The worst thing that'll happen is you'll have a cool experience. And it's amazing how many mind-blowing healing experiences happen. And like you've described, very quickly, even with a hardcore addiction like nicotine, it can really knock you right into a new dimension of yourself.
Right. So true. I totally agree with you. The next book I wrote was Baldur's Magic, The Power of Norse Shamanism in Ecstatic Trance. That's the book that really began with my experience of going back 6,000 years ago, where this group of hunters asked me to go on a hunt with them. It was a personal experience of connecting with my ancestors. And from that experience, I went through a whole sequence of experiences over the next few months of going through Scandinavia, to Denmark, to Sweden, to connect with my ancestors throughout Scandinavia. So this book really is a story about connecting with the ancestors. I'll leave it at that. The next book was Beowulf's Ecstatic Trance Magic. And what that book is about spirits of the earth. I went to Trelleborg, Sweden, the southern tip of Sweden, where I really did ecstatic, on books like this, I did ecstatic trance at least twice a day on different places around southern Sweden. And I had a series of experiences of Queen Wealtheroe, who was the wife of became the queen of King Hrothgar. Anyway, she was, as a princess, she was from Trelleborg, and I went through a whole series of experiences with her. Then I went across the bay to Gamalejra, which is in Denmark, where King Hrothgar had his great hall, and I did experiences there, and I really felt that the story of Queen Wealthroe and King Hrothgar really flowed. What King Hrothgar was basically what you might call a Viking warrior. He was a warrior, but yet his wife was really connected with the mother goddess, and really she was commiserating with the wives of all these retainers of King Hrothgar. And so there was sort of this thing going on between Wealtheroe and Hrothgar, where Hrothgar really wanted his retainers to maintain their strength and practice fighting, but yet he could see that this was making them, taking them into what I might call the patriotic war, masculine world. And so the big part of this is the story of how King Hrothgar and Welthoro sort of dealt with this conflict of how they both were living. But it was a whole, again, came out of a bunch of experience that I had. The next book was Journeys of the Hunter and Gatherers, Trans Journeys of the Hunter and Gatherers, Ecstatic Practices to Reconnect with Our Great Mother and Heal the Earth. And in this book, I have a bunch of experiences of becoming one with the Great Mother, of strengthening our unity with the earth, of really connecting with the earth in a healthy way, and experiences that led with that. This one drew experiences from several other people to really move in the direction of healing the earth. Then there was the ecstatic soul retrieval. The Cuamungi Institute above Santa Fe, New Mexico, is the institute that Felicitas Goodman started, and it's on the Pauqui Pueblo above Santa Fe, and that's where I when I first started playing with ecstatic trance. At this point, Felicitas had already died, but I connected with Belinda Gore, who has written two books on the postures that she's studied.
You know the Belinda
Gore, G-O-R-E, yeah. Belinda, when I went to her with some questions, and the thing she told me is, oh, you need to come to the Institute and be trained to be certified as an instructor. So I took her up on that, and I went to the Cuamungi Institute, where I spent two four-day weekends. And the first was experiencing ecstatic trance. The second one was the mask trance dance, where our experiences were to connect with a spirit guide, a power animal, and mine was a bear. And she looked at each of us in the group, I think it was like eight of us in the group, she came up with a dance, a choreography that we made costumes. We made costumes for our spirit guide, and I was the bear. That's what was funny. At one time, I made this mask. It was a paper mache mask, and I left it outside to dry. The next morning at the breakfast, Richard Bannister came to me and says, "Did you see what happened to your mask? A mouse had eaten one of the ears off the mask, of the paper mache mask."
That's one of your power animals.
I had to redo the mask. I had the mask over here on the wall. So the next morning we were we do our experiences in the kiva. That's semi-underground. That's sort of like a traditional Hopi Indian kiva. In the kiva, all around the walls are all these masks from previous mass trance dances. And I was sitting against the wall on one side and telling of my experience, and it was tied to this mouse eating the ear off the bear. And all of a sudden, one of the women across me let out the squeal and went out the door. And what would happen? A mouse popped up behind a mask on the wall and took off the woman across the
floor. That's great.
So it was an interesting few minutes there.
It's funny, too, because the mouse is one of your power animals. So the mouse came and ate the ear off the bear.
Right. But then I rebuilt it. I put it on again and became the... Oh, yeah. And the costume, the bear costume I had was a brown bathrobe that I had painted on a bunch of mice. So the mice were crawling all over me. So
that's funny.
That was the costume I used on the mass trance dance. But anyway, that was something that Felicitas Goodman had created, the mass trance dance. And those are the two workshops I needed to go through to become a certified instructor. The Key Solomon from Germany, and she's in our Zoom group. She comes about once a month or so. She led a workshop at the Institute on the static soul retrieval. And I went to her workshop, And I had a lot of, it was really a powerful workshop for me, but I realized that how ecstatic soul retrieval is so parallel to analytic hypnotherapy. In analytic hypnotherapy, part of the experience is to go into my unconscious mind and call upon the parts of me that are interfering with my life, then let them die and be reborn. And basically, that's what ecstatic soul retrieval is. I use ecstatic trance instead of analytic hypnotherapy, where I have the person first go into the, use the bear spirit posture to gain strength. Because so often when you face a trauma within you, it's very traumatic, and you tend to maybe want to withdraw from the whole thing. But with the extra strength that the bear spirit posture can give you, it really makes it so you can really face some of the issues in your life that you would like to forget, some having been abused or whatever it might be. And then going into the underworld to find, asking in the underworld, let my adult self go back and be with my younger self and help my younger self find what the trauma is in my life that's bothering me. That's the second session. The third session, we again use the underworld posture, but go on the underworld and ask, what do I need? If I was abused by my father, I might ask, I might say, Dad, I need to have you be gentle with me. Dad, I need to have you listen to me and understand my feelings. Those statements need to be stated in the positive, not the negative. Dad, I don't want you to abuse me. That doesn't work. It doesn't tell the person where they're going. So those experiences need to be positive. Then I do the death rebirth posture of having them, the old way of thinking, die, and the new way of thinking of the healthy. Dad, I need to have you be gentle with me and understand my feelings. Then I see the person another couple times to see if that is really changing their life and their relationship with other people. So that's basically the idea of ecstatic soul retrieval. Then I got into my one academic book, Applying the Constructive Approach to Cognitive Therapy, Resolving the Unconscious Past. If you're familiar at all with cognitive therapy, Aaron Beck says, well, you have to deal with it here and now. And he just makes it sound so simple. But to me, you really need to see where your negative thinking comes from. You need to go into your unconscious past to uncover it, to let go of it. So basically, the constructive approach takes a different approach to cognitive therapy than Aaron Beck. It really looks at how to resolve your unconscious past.
But that's great.
That's a fairly academic book. I look at the, besides ecstatic trance, I look at dream work on using the imagination. Another powerful trance time I have is waking up in the morning. I may lay in bed for maybe an hour, just letting my mind go to see where it goes. And I often have very powerful trance experiences in what I call the morning reverie of just waking up and being half asleep. So that's in my last two books. Oh, this is a book that I wrote probably well before it got published, Loki's Children. Again, like Beowulf, if you know the Prosetta, Loki was the trickster god of, when you think of Odin and Thor and all the Nordic gods. Yeah. Loki was the trickster god, and he's the one that really would confront Odin and Thor, and they restrained him. And finally, at the end of the book, he breaks free, and several other beings break free, and they have the Ragnarok, the final battle, where basically everybody kills everybody else. But Baldur, the gentle son of Odin, the gentle, most beloved son of Odin, comes back to life, and he's the new leader. So again, it really ends again with the similar to Beowulf, or this big struggle with these monsters. Loki's three children are Fenrir the wolf, a wolf that grows and doesn't stop growing, and gets really humongous. Then there is Jormungand, a sea serpent who surrounds the earth and holds his tail in his mouth. Then there's the Hel, the goddess of the underworld. And these are the three children of Loki that he had with this evil giantess. And these three children are the ones that caused so many problems. And so this book really goes into how they deal with these three children and overcome the trauma in the stories to become, and where Baldur becomes the new god, the new god of gods among the Nordic people. My first book, Grendel's Mother, the foreword was written by Mike Bell. And Michael Bell was an old friend of mine who got his PhD in Icelandic literature and from Harvard University. Then he got a teaching spot at Boulder, Colorado, University of Colorado. And he told me that I needed to be careful because a lot of people would look at my story and the Viking type, the warrior type, would disagree with me and they would really. And I got a lot of complaints from that population of people that were trying to reconnect with their warrior gods. And the same thing happened here when I did this book. I was invited by he was a lawyer, but he also, his hobby was Nordic mythology. And he had me come down to his place in Maryland. I think I did it twice where I did workshops down there. Finally, one day he contacted me. He says, "Leave me alone. Forget me. Don't come down anymore." Because he realized that I was sort of on the other side of the fence, looking for ways to overcome the violence of these Nordic Viking stories. So anyway, that's sort of the purpose of that book. And the last book I've written is Listening to the Spirits. And this one, Surviving the Coming Apocalypse with Ecstatic Trance. And in this one, I took the trance experiences I had in different places I visited around the world. Sweden, Denmark, the Chumash Indians in California, the Unchu Hunters of California, the Donan Circle of Ireland, the Esopus of New York, the Sami Reindeer Herders of Finland, my trip to Peru, and then ecstatic trance in New Mexico. On my journeys to each of these places, I had trance experiences twice a day. And this is a collection of what these trance experiences had to say to me. And basically, all of them were looking at where our Earth is going in terms of global warming, in terms of all the problems that we have, finding ways around that. So Listening to the Spirits, Surviving the Coming Apocalypse with Ecstatic Trance. In that story, just one brief one, is the Esopus Indians here in the Hudson Valley. My 9 times great-grandfather, Hybertson Brink, came to Kingston, New York, back in 1659 and settled down. And his wife, they had 3 children early. They had more than that, but during this second Esopus War, the Esopus were a very peaceful Lenape tribe. But when they were being really pressured by the Dutch, when the Dutch were really killing them and happening regularly, they finally had to rise up and they went and they burnt a big part of Kingston, and they also burnt the village of Hurley. And Hurley is where my ancestors lived. And they kidnapped my 9 times great-grandmother and 3 of her children and held them for 3 months. And my experience in there is how when the mother was very, really appreciated the Esopus when she came back, because how gentle they were, how they incorporated her in the village. But she couldn't tell any of the men that because they were all sort of afraid of the Esopus. So anyway, that one chapter in that book really looks at that whole conflict between the Esopus and the early Dutch of the Hudson Valley. So those are the books that I have written, and I have one more that I'm trying to find a publisher for now, which is Listening to the Spirits, the Voices of Genesis, and the Journey to Enlightenment in the Garden. Where that book came from is that in looking at the Nordic mythology, the one story of Idun's apples from her golden apple tree kept the gods young. In other words, the Garden of Idun. Mm-hmm. And when I heard that Garden of Idun, I sort of thought, well, Genesis is also a ancient myth. Maybe I should venture into that. And I met Matthew Wood, an herbalist who had been working with that. And so this basically, I had a group of five of us that we journeyed through the seven stories of Genesis and really saw a very different, I mean, I think the Christian church looks at these stories as being literal history, but there's a real mythical side to them. And the five of us in this group really opened up the door. One of the stories is the Promised Land. In Judaism, they really feel Israel is the Promised Land, and that's what's causing all the conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis. But in our experience, we discovered that the Promised Land is more a frame of mind. It's where you are. It's where you find this new life. And each person had a different place where they really found the power of the chosen land within themselves in the new world, in the new garden or the garden of time. The land of time-free transparency. So really, it's an interesting book that I haven't found a publisher for it yet.
Well, hopefully you will soon. It's a lot of books. It's all very interesting. If I had time, I'd read them all, but I am so busy trying to write my own series of books right now.
Right.
But I love it. I might get your academic book. I'd love to see what you have in there.
A bit more academic one?
Yeah, I think I'm curious just as to what you've shared in there, because I'm very interested. I do a lot of work with the unconscious. I think that's one of the most important missing aspects of people's own personal therapy.
Right.
And more needs to be done in professional therapy for the very reason you mentioned, because you can't really heal trauma until you get to the unconscious roots of it.
Exactly.
Nick, you've been alive for 83 years now. You've seen a lot and done a lot in your life. As you look at the world today, what do you feel we've lost from the wisdom of the natives that would help us heal and integrate as the people of the world at this time?
Patriarchal. I think that the hunter and gatherers live in a very matriarchal world where they really venerate the mother goddess, the matriarchal side of things. Then when we went into the rational world, we got lost in patriarchy. And that's where I think the church really went wrong. They really were trying to make God masculine,
yes,
rather than being the matriarch. And I really feel that we are on the verge of, if we do not destroy ourselves first through global warming, I think there's a lot of hope that we will find this new we'll re-enter the matriarchal world, where we can find really peace and love among us. I think in our current battles, there's so much dissension between racism and so many other sides, that I think with learning to accept, realizing that what we consider, what so many people in this country consider the enemy, has a lot to offer you in terms of you can't know everything because there's so much knowledge that we need to have this diversity of people around us to be part of our community, to give us the what we need to really live in this new world. So I think I have hope. I think maybe we've reached a critical mass to where we are. There's enough of us, you and all these others, the Tai Chi teachers, the Reiki specialists, on and on. There's so many different groups that I think there's enough of them to where if they are able to really promote this new world where we're going, that maybe we could overcome all the oppression of global warming, all the rich and the racists and the evangelical Christians, all these different groups that are really creating such tension in our society now. So hopefully that could be overcome.
Yes, I think that's a very necessary part of our healing and integration process for sure. Nick, as we close the podcast, if you could share a message with the people of the world as a wise elder, what would your message be now?
That we need to appreciate all life. We are no better than all other life. All my spirit guides, I have to look up to them. I'm no better than the bear, no better than the eagle, no better than the honeybee, no better than the mosquito. They all have so much to offer that I need to really appreciate them and really feel like they're a part of our whole life. I think that is sort of so much of what my books are saying, is that how do we really become one with all of the life? Our whole idea of evolution, we have put ourselves above everything else. And that's where we really have gone wrong. We are no better than all other life.
We can't live without them.
We can't live without them. Yeah, there's the interdependency of all life, and that we cannot live without this other life. I mean, so many people are not afraid of animals going extinct, but that's just throwing everything out of balance when that happens. Yes. That we need to really appreciate all life.
I agree 100%. I think reconnecting to nature is super, super important. I think if people would just get out into parks and hike trails and take time to be barefoot and use their imagination and spend time asking themselves, what would my life be like if there was no birds around? What would my life be like if there was no dogs and cats and bears and monkeys? You know, when we think of, even when we look on television, even in cartoons, each of these creatures expresses a unique type of consciousness and a unique type of wisdom. I think if people just ask themselves, you know, one of the exercises I give my students and patients to see how much plant life and tree life adds to their life, I say, have you ever moved into a new house or apartment and noticed what it was like before you put your plants and trees in it, and what it felt like when you brought your plant and tree friends in? And everybody says, oh yes, it went from being this boxy, sterile, empty feeling place to feeling homey and alive. And I said, well, good. Now you know why we got to stop killing everything.
Exactly. Mowing the lawn, I think, is one big thing that destroys the dandelions that take away the very early food of honeybees. We really are into letting back here, they call it a no-mow May. That during the month of May, we're not supposed to mow. So just to let the lawn grow long and the dandelions so it could feed the bees. There's so much that we need to do.
These are important concepts. Thank you for sharing that. And thank you for a beautiful journey today, Nick. It was really fun to spend time with you. You know, I really enjoy being with people that have devoted themselves to so much of their own personal growth and development, helping others. And, you know, you've had a long career of really diving deep into this and really applying it. And I think, you know, we're really lacking exposure to wise elders like yourself. And it's so sad. I mean, we got the only wise people we have that get so much exposure are people like Joe Biden and Donald Trump, but these are not wise elders. They're just crazy people. We need to, they're the ones cutting down the trees and burning up the rainforest. And we've got to really get back to spending more time with people like you to ground us in our authentic roots so that we can reconnect with what's real. I think we've gotten so far into this digital reality that people are losing the realization that there's no responsibility to care for a tree or a plant that's digital, but there's a real responsibility to caring for the very world that takes care of us.
Yeah. So, like I said before, I offered to invite anybody who hears this, if they want to join one of our ecstatic trance groups, just to email me at brinknick9@gmail.com or go to my, on Facebook, go to Nick Brink's apostrophe S, Nick Brink's books. And I sort of have weekly blogs I put on there to give some direction to where we're going.
Yes. And then if people want to buy your books, is Amazon the best place or is there somewhere else?
We avoid using Amazon, but your preferred bookseller has them. You can get them through Amazon. Yes. I like to go to other booksellers, Thrift Books, Barnes and Noble, ABE Books. When I get books, I try to avoid Amazon. But still, if that's what you use, fine. You can get them in Amazon too.
Great. Is there any other websites or anything you want to direct people to find more about you and your work?
I wanted to mention if you join the Ecstatic Trance Group, there's no charge for that. It's open to anybody. Oh, I also have Nick Brink's book reviews. As I review books, I put them on there too. So some people really like to follow my book reviews of books that I've been reading at the moment. But basically, Nick Brink's books are my Facebook site, Nick Brink, or my email, brinknick9@gmail.com. Those are where I would suggest people go.
And your Nick Brink's book reviews, is that a specific site or is that part of another site?
They're part of Facebook.
Okay.
No, Nick Brink's books and Nick Brink's book reviews are all on Facebook.
Fantastic. Nick, what a great journey you took us on today. Thank you.
Oh, and thank you.
It was a real
sort of on track.
Yeah, good. Well, you know, that's my job as the moderator of the podcast. And I was really excited to hear a little bit about each of your books myself, so I know what's in them in case I want to dive into a specific topic. And I'll close by saying thank you to our sponsors for all your great products. Thank you to all of you who buy anything from the podcast sponsors that supports the podcast so I can keep finding amazing wise elders like Nick to keep us enlightened so we don't kill ourselves prematurely and we don't forget our ancestors of the animal and plant and insect worlds and all the other ones. And thanks to all of you guys for being part of the change. If you've listened to us this far, I know you're a real student of truth and have a definite interest in being the change in the world. So I send you all my love, as I'm sure Nick does too.
Yes, definitely.
Look forward to sharing more with you and a very interesting podcast on our next show. So lots of love, and I'll talk to you guys soon.
Thank you for listening to Living 4D with Paul Cech and today's guest, Nicholas Brink. If you are interested in learning more about Nick's ecstatic trance groups, you can find him on Facebook at nick.brink.14 or email him directly at brinknick9@gmail.com. He also has a Facebook page for his books at N.E. Brink, and you can buy them on Amazon. Please see the show notes at checkinstitute.com/podcast for direct links to Nick's books. You can find Paul on Instagram and TikTok at paul.check, on Twitter at paulcheck, or on his YouTube podcast channel, youtube.com/living4D with Paul Cech. You can watch more on Paul's blog at paulchecksblog.com or visit the Czech Institute site at czechinstitute.com to find Paul's e-learning courses, advanced training programs, and to learn more about the Czech Academy. You can read the full show notes and find links to all the resources mentioned in this episode at czechinstitute.com/podcast. A big thank you to our sponsors, Bioptimizers, Paleo Valley, and Organifi. Their support is essential in producing this podcast, and we hope you will show your support by visiting them online and trying all the amazing products they produce. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please do consider leaving us a 5-star rating and a warm review at the top of the show page on Spotify or at the bottom of the show page if you are listening on Apple Podcasts.